I mean, Ben, I love this country. I stand up when the flag goes by. I put my hand over my heart when they play the national anthem. I get tired of people apologizing for America. But I love it enough to admit that we've got issues that we need to focus on and work on and change. We're not number one in science. We're not number one in math. We're not number one in reading. There are a lot of things that are making us less competitive if every day goes by. And I'm worried that maybe it's that 70 or 80% in the middle that is afraid to speak up and is just kind of defaulting to those with the loudest mouth. And that really bothers me.
Dr. Phil McGraw is a psychologist whose indelible impact on psychology, media, and the public's approach to personal and familial issues is unparalleled. With an illustrious career that has seamlessly bridged the realms of psychology, legal consulting, and television, Dr. Phil has become a pivotal figure in American culture, guiding countless individuals through life's multifaceted challenges with his wisdom and expertise. Before Dr. Phil became a television mainstay, he founded Courtroom Sciences, Inc., a pioneering trial science firm that leveraged forensic psychology in the legal arena, collaborating with premier lawyers globally on some of the most significant cases in jurisprudence. His innovative work at CSI not only revolutionized trial consulting, but also inspired the hit CBS series Bull, reflecting Dr. Phil's early professional life. Moving from the courtroom to the TV studio, Dr. Phil launched his daytime TV show in the early 2000s. The show quickly ascended to the top of the viewership ratings, maintaining its position as the number one or number two daytime TV show throughout its run, culminating in its 21st and final season in 2023. Dr. Phil's departure from daytime TV was not a bow from the medium, but a pivot to a new chapter. In early 2023, he announced his retirement from daytime TV, saying, quote, "I'm retiring from daytime TV. I'm not retiring from TV." True to his word, Dr. Phil is now appearing on his nightly program, Dr. Phil Primetime, on his own network, Merritt Street Media. Dr. Phil's contributions to television and psychology have been recognized with 31 Emmy nominations, 2 Emmy Awards as an executive producer, induction into the Broadcasting and Cable Hall of Fame in 2015, and a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame in February 2020. Beyond television, Dr. Phil has dominated the literary world with 9 number one New York Times bestsellers and has ventured into digital media with his podcasts, Fill in the Blanks and Mystery and Murder, Analysis by Dr. Phil, which have both topped the charts. An entrepreneur at heart, Dr. Phil, alongside his son Jay, developed Doctor On Demand, a revolutionary telemedicine platform that has transformed access to medical and psychiatric care. Their philanthropic efforts, particularly through When Georgia Smiled, a Robin McGraw and Dr. Phil Foundation, have made significant impacts on child and family welfare and domestic violence prevention. As we sit down with Dr. Phil today, our conversation will navigate the essential and evolving role of fatherhood in the modern age, informed by Dr. Phil's comprehensive background in psychology and his acute observations of family dynamics in America. We'll explore the challenges fathers face in balancing tradition with the demands of the contemporary world, the impact of societal changes on parenting, and the core values that seem to be eroding in today's culture. Join us for an enriching discussion that promises to delve deep into the essence of fatherhood, the art of parenting, and the societal shifts that have reshaped these roles, seen through the lens of one of America's most influential figures in psychology and media. Dr. Phil, thanks so much for the time. So you have a brand new book out. It's called We've Got Issues, which, yes. But why don't we discuss the issues that you're actually talking about in We've Got Issues? You talk about the problems with the country and how to solve them. So what do you think are the biggest problems facing the country right now?
Well, right now, I think family's under attack, for one thing. And by that, I mean a lot of the core values that I believe has made this the country that everybody wants to be in, obviously, because there's sure a lot of people trying to get here. I think this attack is in part the unintended consequences of technology, for example, the unintended consequences of really rapid change. And I think some of it is that we've got factions in this country. I call it the tyranny of the fringe, that are trying to hijack the narrative in America by redefining things that we have always held to be true, not just because. I hate when people say, well, why do you do that? Well, because. But because of facts, history, science, biology, just the things that you can empirically define and look to as some type of truth. And I think when these core values come under attack, you start getting a lot of confusion. You start getting people trying to make up realities just because that's what they wish was the fact. And I think it creates a lot of erosion of reality for people. I see it happening at the family level. I see it happening in the educational system. I see it happening in K through 12, and I see it happening in our universities. And that's really bothersome to me, because I look at where we stand on the global scene, and you know, I think this is a great country, and I love America. I love this country. I stand up when the flag goes by. I put my hand over my heart when they play the national anthem. I get tired of people apologizing for America. But I love it enough to admit that we've got issues that we need to focus on and work on and change. But, you know, we're not number one in science. We're not number one in math. We're not number one in reading. There are a lot of things that are making us less competitive if every day goes by. And I worry that maybe it's that 70 or 80% in the middle that is afraid to speak up and is just kind of defaulting to those with the loudest mouth. And that really bothers me.
So you mentioned a lot of things there. The thing that you started with, though, is family. And obviously, we've seen familial breakdown in the United States over the course of the last 60 years, not just in terms of fatherlessness, which has become just the way things are currently done, unfortunately. Predominantly, you know, there's still two-parent households. I believe majority of families are two-parent households, but not by much. Brand-new children, depending on your community, are maybe born most of the time in a household with no father present. But I think there's something else that's deeper going on with regard to American family, and that is the shift from family as a place where duty is learned to a place that is therapeutic in nature, that family is just about love as opposed to about duty. Because for virtually all of human history, family units were about the duties that you owe to each other, that parents owe to children, the duty of respect that children owe to parents, the duties that you owe to your brothers and sisters to take care of them and make sure that they're taken care of and that they're safe. And it seems as though family being the central institution of society, as we've moved away from a duty-based vision of family toward a therapeutic vision of family, where it's all about just the love that you feel for one another, which isn't about duty, it's about the feelings that you can engender in each other, that's been a really tragic turn for the family.
Well, I think it's been a tragic turn in that, as you say, the absence of the father has been a really big issue. And I think when you look at the impact of the single parent family in terms of where those children wind up educationally, where they wind up criminally, where they wind up in replicating that pattern in their own life, the numbers are not good. And we know, for example, if a woman has children and she has a non-biological male in the home, you know, just a boyfriend living in the home or someone, the likelihood of sexual or physical abuse goes up 33 times normal. So, you know, the interesting thing about the passage of time, Ben, is you don't have to speculate, you can measure. And with the passage of time and seeing this happen so much compared to the 60s, for example, just, you know, over the last 50 or 60 years, we've seen this change. That passage of time allows us to measure. And so we know that the vulnerability of these children across time has gone up so much when you have non-biological males in the household. And when you talk about, you know, duty in the home, you know, the most powerful role model in any child's life is the same-sex parent. The second most powerful model is the other-sex parent. They're the ones that are modeling responsibility. They're the ones that are modeling the moral compass, the ethical codes, the things that the work ethic, all the things that prepare these children for the next level of life. And now there's this push that I guess we're supposed to co-parent with teachers. We're supposed to co-parent with the schools and who know absolutely nothing about your child, and have an agenda that you may not have chosen at all, but they're down there talking about these things. And I don't think they're accosting these children when they come through the door of the school in wholesale fashion, pushing these agendas on them. But if it's happening at all, it's happening too much. They need to be educating the children, not installing values that they need to be getting at home. At this point, over 30% of fifth graders can't read a simple sentence. Almost as many eighth graders can't read a sentence. 19% of high school graduates can't read a prescription label or the instructions that come with a prescription. But yet they keep getting moved along in the educational system because that's where the money is. They talk about pronouns. They don't even know what a pronoun is. How about we teach them what a pronoun is before we start talking to them about which ones they want to use? That kind of thing really bothers me.
You know, when you talk about the fringes hijacking all these discussions, what you talk about here is pure common sense. And it feels like these are 80-20 propositions at best. I mean, they may be 90-10 propositions that say the family is important, that parents have the responsibility, the chief responsibility of inculcating values, that the educational system is supposed to be there to teach you a skill set and hopefully to install in you a feeling of citizenship that traditionally that's what education did. These are all 80-20, 90-10 propositions, but it feels like these have now become captured by a political class who are making a lot of money and gaining a lot of power off the back of fringe arguments. How much of that do you think is just because the power of online in our lives has become so great that everybody just needs to get outside and touch some grass?
Oh, my God, Ben, I don't know how much time we have today, but I don't know that it's enough to describe how much I think this has changed. I'll tell you, the Industrial Revolution, and of course, there have been, however you want to define it, there's been maybe three or four Industrial Revolutions, but I think the advent of the smartphone, which came along in 08, 09, when it was like planes flew over the country and dropped these smartphones on everybody. And look, great benefits to technology, right? The fingertip information. Kids don't know what a library is anymore. And it's a big building with books in it, by the way, if you're listening to this. But the ability to not just Google something and believe what you read, but there's Scholastic Google. You can actually access real research that's peer-reviewed and replicated. There are benefits to the technology. There's no question about that. But I mentioned the unintended benefits to this. And, I always think, and I don't remember who actually said it, was someone much smarter than I, that said you can measure the value of certain things by how much of your being, your efforts, your energy, your time, it absorbs from you in exchange for what you get from it. And when you look at, apply that to these cell phones, iPads, computers, and they take anywhere from 40, 60, 70 hours a week out of certainly our young people's lives. And what happened is when these things were dropped and they're so powerful, we think about these phones, there's as much computing power in this phone or an iPad more than we had when we put a man on the moon. We didn't have that much, and we're walking around with that in our hands. And what happened is these kids stopped living their lives and started watching people live their lives. And Ben, the lives they were watching lived were produced. They weren't real. I've had influencers come on the show and confess to me, the life that I'm putting that's made me an influencer, the life that I'm putting on the air, on social media, is a fiction. You probably know this, but there's a place in Santa Monica that has a fake private jet fuselage that you can go rent for 15 minutes at a time. And these influencers go and they'll put on all their ski clothes and say, well, I'm on a private jet headed to Aspen for a big ski vacation. And then they quick change and put on stuff like they're headed to Cancun for the weekend. And they'll shoot up a year's worth of different seasons. And then they go shoot all of this stuff surrounding it like this is their famous life. And these kids watch that and go, man, what a loser am I? I don't have a life like that. So their self-worth is damaged. Their self-image is damaged. they're comparing their reality to this fictional life. And sure enough, in 08, 09, 10, we saw the highest levels of anxiety, depression, and loneliness in our young people since records have started being kept. And it just kept getting worse. And then COVID hits. And when COVID hits, it spikes even more. And what really bothers me is the same people that keep those records, the same people that monitor that level of mental and emotional illness among our young people are the same ones that shut the schools down. And you know, when they shut it down for a couple of weeks, I said, okay, I get it. They got to get their bearings. But when they shut them down for a year and then 18 months and then 2 years in some parts of the country, I said publicly at the time, the mismanagement of COVID, the mismanagement of this quarantine is going to exact a higher toll on our young people than the virus ever could possibly. And people talked, they labeled me as some kind of Looney Tune, some kind of heretic. And then when that all came true, I've been watching my phone, been watching my email. I haven't seen anybody say, hey, sorry, we said all that because it's all come true now. I haven't gotten any of those messages. But the fact of the matter is it cost millions of years of life for these young people because it disrupted their emotional development, their social development, their educational attainment. So they'll achieve less in life. They'll get lesser jobs. They'll have lesser insurance. They'll have slower diagnosis, later intervention. I mean, they'll have years of life shaved off at the far end. So it's had a terrible impact on these children, and I'm not sure that – and there are some efforts being made to close that gap, and some gap has been closed, but not near enough.
We'll get to more on this in a moment. First, the cost of living has already increased 17% this year and continues to rise despite interest rate controls. Our national debt is skyrocketing. These are turbulent economic times. That's why you need to fortify your savings, and you need to do it right now. Birch Gold is the proven industry leader you want on your side. They demonstrate how precious metal investments can fortify your lifestyle and retirement, even, and perhaps most prominently, in uncertain economic times. Birch Gold understands that navigating financial decisions can be daunting. Their experts are always available to provide answers and clarity. Whether it's about fees, taxes on rollovers, or the timing of the process, they're dedicated to keeping you informed. If you're considering converting an existing retirement account into a precious metals IRA, their dedicated in-house IRA department will guide you every step of the way. Text Ben to 989898 to talk to one of Birch Gold's experts and claim your free info kit on gold. You'll learn how to convert an existing IRA or 401k into a tax-sheltered IRA in gold. The best part is, it's not going to cost you a penny out of pocket. Just text Ben to 989898 to get started. Again, text Ben to 989898 to get started. You should diversify. It's just a smart financial strategy. Text Ben to 989898. You know, one of the things that you talk about when you're talking about the rise of social media and the gap between the sort of fiction that's been created on social media for kids and what kids are actually likely to experience, that also manifests as a hatred for the meritocracy, because the truth is that in any sort of meritocracy, the people who ride to the top are not the people who are faking it at some sort of fuselage in Santa Monica. I mean, the way that you rose to the top, or the way that somebody like me, like, that is tens of thousands of hours of hard work and things that people never see. And they see the success at the very end of the story, but they never see the fact that, you know, for me personally, that involved me driving to, you know, meetings in the middle of Temecula, selling books out of the back of my car at the very beginning of my career with my wife. And if we got 10 books sold at $20 a pop, that was like an amazing, amazing day, right? I mean, that's, you know, nobody ever sees that part of it. And the truth is that that journey is the fulfilling journey, that if you go immediately to the top, that's actually not particularly fulfilling. It's all the work that you put in to get to the top of the meritocracy that's actually quite fulfilling. And the meritocracy also happens to be the only system ever devised by man that has positive externalities that actually helps other people. Because when meritorious people, when you're talking about the smartest people or the strongest people or the wisest people, when those people end up at the top of the heap, that has good effects on everybody else, because any other system, whether it's based on race, whether it's based on class, is going to have negative effects. It's stealing from people who are more meritorious and who have, you know, good effects on those around them. But when you have young people and what they see is people who are instantaneously at the top of the heap, and then they say, well, there's no way that I can get there. There's no way that I'm going to be on a jet to Aspen next year or on the way to Cancun. Instead, what they start to do is they rebel against the entire system as they perceive it, even though the system itself, as they perceive it, is false. It's not real.
Yeah, and here's the thing. This is, from a psychological standpoint, one of the things that bothers me is when we see we see what you just described happening, and we see parents who are smoothing out the bumps in the road for their kids. And I think we've got way too many concierge parents who are filling out the college applications for the child. They're racing up there and trying to resolve conflicts if the child has them. And we're seeing all of this kind of petitioning for equality of outcome. I'm okay. We can talk about equality of opportunity. We don't have that either. I mean, we can talk about that in a minute. But this equality of outcome that is being taught and espoused in the schools, what happens is we have these kids being cheated out of the opportunity to observe themselves overcoming these obstacles. When a kid goes out there and does a good job and overcomes a hurdle, overcomes an obstacle, they're able to say, hey, I did that. I overcame that. And I saw myself do that. So they attribute to themselves the ability to handle that, the ability to do that. You observed yourself selling books out of the back of your car. And Robin and I have been married 47 years. And when we got married, if it wasn't for 2-for-1 burger bucks, one of us would have starved. So you go through that, and you don't realize you have a bad deal at the time. It's not like it was trauma. I'm not whining about it now. We were fine. We had a good time. But you observe yourself going through that and say, I've never been afraid of being poor because I can do poor. I've seen me do poor. I know I can do it. Long as I've got a good pair of tennis shoes and a ball that bounces, I'm okay. So I don't fear it, but I know that about myself because I've seen me do it. So many kids are cheated out of that because you've got all of these people out there saying, hey, we should have a quality of outcome. So I read that to be, all right, if you're home in a beanbag eating Cheetos, and then somebody else is working 12, 14 hours a day, at the end of the month, you should be in the same place. You should have the same outcome. That's insanity. But that's what's being taught in our schools. I'm not saying that just in a anecdotal sort of way. The number of university professors that are left-leaning, liberal, everybody should come out the same, versus those that are really honor a meritocracy and hard work, the ratio is so out of balance, I'm really concerned. That's what I mean when I say we got issues.
Yeah, and the social engineers obviously have taken control of the train, and it's a really major problem. When you mentioned parenting here, I want to get your thoughts on parenting. What are the best ways to parent? Because obviously I have four kids. They range in age from 10 years old to 10 months old. And one of the hardest things as a parent of young kids is to let them fail. It's really, really, really difficult. But the truth is that unless you let them fail, they never learn to succeed because they actually achieve a sort of learned helplessness in which they're waiting for me to come in and solve their problems. And it's very difficult as a parent to watch your kids struggle and cry over a math problem and have a really difficult time. But the minute you step in and solve the problem for them, what they take away from that is that they are incapable of solving the problem at any point in the future. You have to actually let them sit there and struggle and cry. And it's really rough as a parent, but it may be the most important thing that you can do as a parent, it seems to me.
It's one of the greatest gifts you can give them is allowing them to master a certain skill set, a certain challenge. And look, everything is a balance, right? I think if a child is getting relentlessly bullied, if they're being targeted in some way, a little bit of that is not necessarily bad either. A child needs to understand, hey, I can be picked on and I came back from it, I'm okay. They could have a teacher that's unfair and you can look at it and say, yeah, they really are unfair. But you just have to buck up and get through it. That's okay. But if you have a child that is really being isolated and targeted, you need to let them know, hey, you're not alone. I got your back and I'm here with you. So, it's everything in balance. It's the parents that rush in and don't let the child scrape their knee. Don't let the child fail the test because they didn't do the work, they didn't prepare. It's the parent that says, we got to have trophies and a pizza party at the end of an 0-14 basketball season. And I coach some of those, so I know. Because, I would coach at the Y and you'd have the 12-14 age bracket or the 8-10. And when you come in at the 8 level, you're playing those that are 2 years older, you're going to get beat every game for a while. And they need to learn, hey, that's okay. Next year, we'll win half the games. And the next year, we'll win them all because we'll be the older kids. They learn that you've got to develop the skills. You've got to let them take those lumps. And what you have to tell yourself is, hey, this is me letting them get a thick skin. This is me letting them observe themselves fail and get back up. And they can't observe themselves getting up if they never fall down. And so you so cheat them out of it. And I think parents are so cheating their child. And let me tell you something. They're not doing that for the child. They're doing that to make themselves feel better. That's just like the mother that enables the kid on drugs. And she said, oh, well, I do give him money, or I do let him stay at the house when he's doing drugs because I love him so much. No, you're doing that so you don't feel anxious about where he is that night. You're giving him money to put poison in his veins so you sleep better, not because you're concerned about him. You're doing it so you feel better about who you are. That's what enabling is all about. And we got a lot of parents enabling their children to make themselves feel better. They're not doing it for the child. They're doing it for themselves. They just don't recognize that. And they hate it when I tell them that, but it's the truth.
I mean, you see so much of it these days, and especially, again, exacerbated by social media. So parents who are treating their own parenting as sort of an Instagram or TikTok exercise, where most frequently now, you'll see a parent who will take a little boy who expresses gender confusion or may not even express gender confusion and says, well, you're a little girl. And then they take pictures of themselves on TikTok and put videos up of themselves. Look how tolerant and wonderful and diverse our family is, avoiding the simple fact, which is that boys are boys and girls are girls, and that's not solving anybody's problem. It's just about you making yourself more popular on the social media networks. I mean, you want to do tremendous damage to a child, exacerbate the child's confusion. What children are looking for all the time is some semblance of stability. And we are, as a society, removing every semblance of stability. We're removing both parents in the home. We're suggesting that one parent is enough, if even one parent. We're removing the idea that adults, as a general rule, have wisdom to impart to kids, that they actually have rules. What kids are looking for is rules and truths and realities about life. And what parents are doing is running away from those as though that's some sort of imposition on the child. There's this famous story about Rousseau after he wrote the book Emile, which was supposedly about the education of a child who basically learns his way by running around the forest, where a woman came up to Rousseau and says, well, Rousseau, Jean-Jacques, your book is amazing. I've been raising my kid like that. And Rousseau apparently looked at her and said, are you a fool? How could you possibly raise your kid like that? You can't release your kids into the wilderness and then expect them to live. That's not the way any of this works.
It's really giving your power away. And it's astounding to me that people are so influenced by strangers, people they don't know on these social media platforms, and how shocked would they be if they knew how many of those aren't even real people. I asked a group the other day, what do you understand about bots? And they said, well, I understand that they're like fake accounts and sometimes people put them up to drive an issue. I said, well, how many would you consider to be in a bot army? And they said, oh, I think thousands. And I said, really? Would it surprise you to know that these bot farms have millions and millions of these fake accounts that they can deploy at any one time, and that they're, some of them are 8, 10, 12-year-old accounts that look so real because they befriend each other on these accounts. They have this matrix where they have pictures and friends, but when you drill down, would it surprise you to know that you're behaving in a way to please a very small group of people that have created these fake bot armies to influence your behavior? And they're stunned. But but they still do it. It's like I'm being attacked on the internet as though the internet is a real place. It's not the town square, which was what it's designed to be, but that's not how it works. And I put out videos of which some of them now have been taken down because they say they violate community principles. And they took down the one where I criticized our elite universities. I said they're fostering intellectual rot when you have these organizations that are supporting Hamas, that you've got them supporting murderers. I mean, this is a terrorist group. And you have these elite universities with dozens of groups with hundreds and hundreds of kids. When did they stop teaching critical thinking? I don't understand how they don't teach. I see this banner, Gays for Palestine. Are you kidding me? Why don't you take that banner and walk across the border into Gaza and see how far you get? But yet they don't understand that. It's like I'm stunned that we're not teaching critical thinking among our young people.
And I think that a lot of what you're talking about here is exactly the sort of call and response that you see on the internet. That if you say the slogan, then millions of bots or people who are supposedly like-minded will come and cheer for you, and then you do it again, and you get more engagement. That the best way to get engagement is to continue appealing to these very specific subgroups of people and to continue hitting it over and over and over. And as you see the engagement increasing, it creates this incentive structure where you can say things that literally make no sense, or you can say things that you know nothing about, and you get cheers for it. I mean, there's a very funny video from my friend Ami Horowitz where he actually went to some of these universities and he said, do you agree with From the River to the Sea, Palestine will be free? And so many people say, sure, yes. And he said, okay, which river and which sea? And they couldn't name either the river or the sea because they literally have no idea what they're talking about. They just know that if they do the call, then they get the response. And it also happens to be the truth that a lot of these social media platforms, TikTok being the most obvious one, are actually gamed by America's foreign enemies. I mean, China obviously owns TikTok. ByteDance is in charge of TikTok. And the way that you can tell that they are weaponizing TikTok is by the simple fact that TikTok in China is teaching kids math problems, and TikTok in the United States is teaching people how to be increasingly insane. And so what this does raise the question of is whether, you know, the United States and the government, we're seeing it in the state of Florida, we're seeing it in the state of Texas as well, and some other states, how heavily should the U.S. government, particularly states, be restricting access, particularly for minors, to outlets like TikTok, like Instagram, like social media?
Well, we know that there is a certain age group now that report that they get 100% of their news from TikTok. Now, listen, I spent a lot of time doing work in the litigation arena. I did trial science work where we did assistance in jury selection and trial strategies and witness prep and time in the courtroom. And one thing I learned for sure, I would see lawyers up in front of the bench arguing real hard to get a piece of evidence in, and they wouldn't get it in, and they would come back and say, well, we didn't get it in, but the jury knows we've got something really powerful, and that registered with them. Say, no, it didn't. Juries make decisions on what they see and hear, not on what they don't see and hear. That is a simple truth. And when we see so many of our young people getting their news, getting their information, all from a controlled source, they make their decisions based on what they see and hear, not on what they don't see and hear. So we know that propaganda that's being pushed on them, we see so many of these young people that go on, and toxic information the algorithm feeds to them because they click more when they're emotionally involved, emotionally upset, than they do if it's a box of warm puppies. And there have been studies done, very simple studies, where if you add just even two words to the name of an account, like Lauren Lose Weight was one of the studies that I mentioned in the book, the amount of toxic information that was pumped to her just by adding lose weight to the title of her account went up 12-fold within the first few minutes because they say, okay, she started getting 400-calorie diets, 700-calorie diets, anorexia sites pumped her way. And they say, well, we don't mean to upset them or get their mental health in jeopardy. Yes, you do, because it gets more clicks. That's the algorithm has no conscience. The algorithm has one job, and that's to get more clicks for more ad money. It doesn't care who it hurts. It has no conscience. And the only conscience is who's putting that algorithm in play. And the profit motive overrides the moral compass. And so kids are in jeopardy when they do that. And when you've got China, they restrict the amount of time kids can be on there, and they're teaching math, science, that sort of thing, which is why we're 34th in science, 16th in math, 9th in reading. Those numbers change and move day to day. So fact check me, and you might get a different number from a different organization. But suffice it to say, we ain't number one, and guess who is? It's the ones who are focusing on academic achievement and not us. And we need to be restricting that and making certain that we're focusing on preparing these people for the next level of life. When you go to college and they don't teach, they don't call out toxic masculinity, they say masculinity is toxic. Ambition, entrepreneurship, driving towards a goal, those things are gauche. Oh no, you don't want to be talking about that. That's not good. those are the kind of things that I really fear are heading us down a path that's not going to bode well in the future.
We'll get to more on this in just a moment. First, we all spend way too much time on our phones, and all the while, your phone carrier is collecting data on your activity. Several phone carriers have even admitted to it. They say it's so they can better understand your interests, but really, all they want to do is sell your activity to advertisers like the sites you've visited and the videos you've watched. The more they can get on you, the larger their paycheck, which is why I use ExpressVPN. ExpressVPN is an app that prevents your phone carrier from being able to track your online activity and sell it off to third parties. All it takes is one tap of a button. Your network data is encrypted and rerouted through ExpressVPN's secure servers for ultimate privacy. ExpressVPN shields your web browsing and protects all of your network data, so you can stay private, even when using your favorite apps. Whether you're an iPhone, Android, or tablet user, ExpressVPN works on all your devices. The best part is that one subscription can be used on up to 5 devices at the same time. I've got my whole family using ExpressVPN as well. When your phone carrier tracks you, that's a gross invasion of privacy. Visit expressvpn.com/Ben to get the same VPN I use. Use my link to get 3 extra months for free at expressvpn.com/Ben. Again, that's expressvpn.com/Ben. That's the VPN I use. You should do the same. expressvpn.com/Ben to get 3 extra months for free. You know, it seems to me that you mentioned this right at the top, that the pace of technological change is screwing with the brain in ways that we have never seen in human history before. That the way that everybody is glued to their phone, that you can't go into a subway and everybody isn't glued to their phone, that you can't be around a dinner table and half the family is attached to their phone. And that's leaving aside what's about to happen with AI, which has become so insanely sophisticated that it can essentially mimic very high-level function for human activities. And so, you know, I've talked with a lot of folks who are experts in AI, people who have developed a lot of these AI systems, and they're talking about the capabilities of these AI systems. And they say basically what's publicly available right now is a fraction of what exactly they're developing behind closed doors, that within just a few years, you're going to have what they call generalizable AI, meaning that you're no longer going to even have to type in various prompts. You're going to type in one prompt, like solve cancer, and it's just going to iterate. It's going to know which questions to ask next in order to get to an end. And that could come with an amazing good, but could also come with tremendous evil, which is if we're worried about the enervation of the population right now, given our access to phones, given the fact that we don't think that we need to learn a skill set because the technology can do it for us, what happens to human beings when their entire sense of purpose is robbed from them by AIs that are capable of doing things better and faster? It seems to me that a lot of the things that develop the human brain are going to go away, and we're not even going to realize what the costs of those are until way too late. Nobody my age, for example, knows how to do, unfortunately, simple calculation anymore, because everybody, when they were growing up, had a calculator. What happens when no one knows how to read anymore? Because legitimately, there's no reason to read a bunch of books in order to get the information. You just give the AI a prompt and it spits out what you, quote unquote, need to know.
Well, I'll give you a great example of that already happening. How many phone numbers do you know? I know almost no phone numbers, because all I got to do is just say, you know, call Robin, call Ben, call so-and-so. I don't know the numbers because they're stored. They're in there. That's just a very rudimentary example of technology taking that away. I used to know all these phone numbers, my kids' phone numbers, my wife's phone number, my friends' phone numbers. But when I didn't need to do that anymore, that atrophied, and I don't have that in my memory anymore. Phone numbers were designed seven digits because human memory comfortably remembers seven digits, particularly if they're broken up three and four. That's just a function of human memory. And now that has atrophied because we are able to just click it. And when you start adding in deep fakes with AI, I have seen myself in ads, me speaking in ads for products I've never even heard of. And we send cease and desist letters and all, and so that corporation will disappear and it'll pop up across the street with a new name the next day, same product, maybe different product. And it's like stomping ants at a picnic. I mean, you can't get rid of them already. What's going to happen on the eve of election when it's too late to effectively respond and they have a deep fake, I mean, scarily looking replica of a candidate saying, hey, well, something's happened, I'm withdrawing here, or I confess to some horrible crime, don't vote for me, it would be a waste of your vote. I mean, it could change the election on the eve of an election so fast it'd make your head spin. That's all, we're already there. And that worries me a lot. And AI has passed a bar exam in one of the states. It's pretty scary technology. And what I believe is we've got to focus on the human aspects of our culture, the human aspects of our family. Maybe it'll get to the point that it can replicate that, but I'm the incurable optimist. And I think if my lawyers tell me the best way to fight AI is to get your content out there better than anybody else could, and then everything becomes a cheap knockoff. And I feel that way about families. I feel that way about our society. We need to do a better job than those that are trying to rob us of it can do with their theories and their new ideas about what will make this world tick. But, you know, I put out 10 principles for a healthy society, and we've got issues, how you can stand strong for America's soul and sanity. And the number one on the list is be who you are on purpose. We got to live with intention. I mean, just waking up and letting the world tell us what to think, let the world tell us how to behave. We've got to be who we are on purpose. We got to live with intention, and we have to own it. We got to be big enough to own what we believe, you know, speak the truth and own what we believe. And the number of people that are afraid to speak their mind now is triple what it was in 1950.
I think one of the things that speaks to a lot of this is, again, to get back to that sort of touch grass sentiment. It seems to me that the thing that we've lost more than anything else over the course of my lifetime is just interconnection with other human beings in normal settings. This has gone completely away. We're all working remote, for example, so you don't even have contact with people at the office. We no longer go to church. I mean, church going in the United States has declined extraordinarily over the course of the last half century, which means that you don't actually see people on a weekly basis, even, who you consider to be friends and family. Family units have fragmented to the extent that we think of the nuclear family if that, as the only form of family, as opposed to kinship networks, which used to be the way that virtually all societies work. I'm very lucky. You know, I live in an Orthodox Jewish community. Because of our laws, because of our rules, you can't drive and you can't use technology one day a week. So that means that we are all together, hundreds of us, in the same place once a week for 25 hours. I live within walking distance of my parents. I live walking distance of my wife's parents. I live within walking distance of one of my sisters, and the other is about a mile and a half away. And so that means that we are constantly interfacing with normal, everyday human beings who actually have our best interests at heart. And that does lead you to actually recommit to things that matter. But as all of the areas of commonality go away, those areas of commonality can't be built across broad distances by virtue signaling on Twitter. The only way you can actually build commonality of interest and actual duty is at the extremely local level. And that starts inside the family, and that broadens out to your local community. If you don't have family, you don't have local community, you got nothing.
Yeah. You know, I've got two boys, and they're both grown and married and have children. So I have four grandchildren, and I feel so blessed that I am able to interact with both of our boys at least three or four times a week. And I was very nefarious about this. I planned it that way because they're in professions that intersect. I figured a way to worm my way in so we can intersect a lot, even if it's just talking about a business thing. And then that really spawned some common activities, whether it's, you know, playing golf or, you know, getting together over music or things like that. And I tell you, it's the greatest blessing of my life to have commonality with my sons on a regular basis. And you know, sometimes it is with technology. I'll pick up the phone and they send me a cartoon, something that they saw that they thought was funny, or something that happened with the grandkids or whatever. And then we get together and spend time and have dinner. And there's no replacement for it. There's nothing that you can do technologically that substitutes or them coming in the door and giving you a hug and handing you a grandkid or whatever, and just spending time together. There is nothing that replaces that, and nothing that ever can replace that.
You know, actually, our executive producer, Justin, toured in a band with your son, Jordan. He told us about how you interfaced with them and how you reacted to the fact that they were pursuing music. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that, because apparently you're the cool dad. This is what I hear from my producer.
Oh my God! You wouldn't get that from my kids. I listened to 60s. They say, "Hey, your oldies are getting old." But yeah, my son Jordan, you wouldn't think, but he's got more tattoos than you could shake a stick at. Which I have none, by the way. But you know, you meet your kids where they are, and my other son has zero, but my youngest son Jordan has lots, and he's very talented, very gifted. And he doesn't let us come very often because, you know, your parents come watch you. But he let us come when he was performing at Madison Square Garden and the Hollywood Bowl and places like that. So, which is really great. You know, you get, because I've seen him play at the Roxy when there's 10 people out there. And like you say, you're selling books out of the back of your car, and he's out there playing to the ushers and stuff like that early on. And then next thing, you know, years have gone by, it's 15 years have gone by, and he's at Madison Square Garden and he's touring with the Jonas Brothers and all that. And it's just been great fun. And I'm so proud to see him do it and have supported it. I made a deal. I said, okay, look, I can support your music 100% if you go to college. At the time, I thought it was really important for him. And he said, okay, I'll do that. And he kept his end and I kept my end. And so it's, you know, one of the smartest things I did, and I'll pat myself on the back about this. He came to me one time when he was a junior in high school and said, what do you want for Christmas? You're the worst person to buy for, because if you want something, it's usually like a tennis racket or tennis shoes, and you just go get it. I don't know what to get you. And I said, okay, I'll tell you what I want. I want you to give me an hour a week, one-on-one, to talk about anything I want to talk about. And he said, done. I said, no. I want you to think about this because this is a big commitment and I'm going to hold you to it. And I said, so you go sleep on it and come back and think about it because we're going to actually do it. And he did and came back and said, yeah, I want to do it. And I bet out of 52 weeks, we probably got 40 of them in, and then, you know, stuff got in the way. But that was a time that we talked about everything from change, how to change the oil in a car, checking accounts, why sports car insurance was more than sedan insurance, everything you could imagine, you know, mowing the lawn, cleaning, just everything that they don't teach anymore. It's just, like you say, out touching the grass. And it was so funny. After about 3 weeks, he started coming around saying, when are we going to do our hour? And he really got interested in it. We started talking about stuff really candidly about life experiences. And he knew that I was homeless when I was 14 for several months in Kansas City. And he said, I want to know about this. I want to know how you do that. And because I'd never talked about that much, he knew it from Robin, and we talked about those things, and it was the greatest time. And you know, every once in a while now, he'll bring up. He said, you know, we talked about this back there, and we talked about mechanical things and financial things and all sorts of stuff that they just don't teach anymore.
You know, what you're talking about there is something that, one of the great lies I think that's been told to parents is that there's such a thing as quality time as opposed to quantity time. The reality is that what was smart about that is that you said quantity of time, meaning it's an hour. It's not we're going to have a good conversation a week. It's that we're going to spend an hour. And whether the conversation's good or bad, yeah, it's going to be an hour. And this is something in my own life that I've really tried to do is just maximize the amount of time that I spend with my kids. I brag about the idea that I've sort of designed my days such that my kids, for their part, believe I don't have a job. That doesn't mean I don't. I definitely have a job, and I'm definitely working all the hours where I'm not with the kids. But it does mean that when I get up in the morning, I'm with the kids until they go to school. I try to pick them up from school, and then I try to spend as much time as I can between that and bedtime with the kids. And there really is no substitute for that because you just don't know when a great conversation is going to happen. And it turns out that sometimes it's not even the great conversations that matter to your kids. It turns out that sometimes it's just you sitting there and doing Legos with them or helping them with their homework or having them sit on your lap. I mean, that's the stuff I remember about doing with my dad, who spent an extraordinary amount of time with me when I was a kid and continues to today, actually. I mean, again, my parents live around the corner. They're at our house pretty much every day. And that's a wonderful blessing. I think that the destruction of that time, the taking up of that sort of time with the nonsense that is things like social media, it's such a destructive force because minutes are not fungible. It's not as though you can take a minute and split it 10 different ways. The minute is going to be used in one way or the other way. It's a zero-sum game. And so you can either spend that with your family doing things that are meaningful, or you can spend that browsing Instagram and you know, screwing your family by not spending the time with them.
Yeah, you know, I tell parents all the time, talk to your children about things that don't matter. They said, well, what do you mean? And I said, yeah, you see these TV shows and they take people in the ER. What's the first thing they say? They say, start an IV with Ringer's lactate. Nobody knows what that means. But I tell them what it means is they're just getting a vein open. So when they figure out what they do need, they've got a vein open so they can give it to them. They're just getting it open with saline. So when they figure it out, they're ready. It's the same way with kids. Talk to them about things that don't matter. So when it comes time to talk about things that do, that pathway is open and it doesn't feel so awkward because the first time you sit down to talk to your children is something that's really difficult. It's going to be awkward. It's going to be tough. You want to have practiced this a lot. That needs to be a well-worn path when it comes time for them to say, hey, I need to talk to you about something. I did something really stupid. They need to know they can come to you and you're not going to blow up. You're not going to come unhinged. You may not like it, but they know they can talk to you about it. They can predict what your response is going to be. And I think that's why sometimes it is quantity. It's not quality. Sometimes just shooting baskets out back or something. And that's when they're likely to come up with something you need to hear or you can disclose something they need to hear.
That also means you have to be really, I think for me with my own kids, you have to be really tuned into what your kids are interested in. I think one of the mistakes that parents make is, well, I'm interested in X, therefore my kids should be interested in that same thing. My kids all have a variety of interests, and they're very different interests. My son, for example, it's nothing but machines and space and specs. I mean, I literally had to get him an encyclopedia of submarines so that he can learn what the specs are on military submarines. He's seven. And he'll sit there asking me, like, what's the difference between a Typhoon class and an Ohio class submarine? I don't know what the hell the difference is between a Typhoon class and an Ohio class submarine. But now I have to look it up.
Because that's
what he wants to know. And I may not even be interested in that thing. But by showing that I'm interested in the thing that he's interested in, now he knows that I'm with him. It's not even about, you know, this idea of showing emotional sympathy as much as it is the idea of I'm interested in what you have to say. And that's the way you treat your kids like future adults.
Yeah, for sure. And look, if they feel your passion for what they're interested in, if they feel like you're interested in them, that's the greatest gift you can give them, because they think you get up 10 minutes before them and let the sun out every morning. And I don't care how much they roll their eyes when you're telling them something. I hear parents all the time say, my kids just don't listen. Well, they may not look like they're listening, but I can tell you what, they're always watching. They're always watching what you do, where you invest your time, where you do what you do, and how you react to them. And if your children want to make you laugh, laugh. If your children want to get you engaged, engage. What a gift it is. I can't tell you how many parents I meet that would give their front seat in hell for their child to want them involved in their life as adults, but they're just not, because they were never involved as young people when they were kids. And that's what I mean when I say I am optimistic. We can turn this around. We're losing this fight in America right now by default. We just need to, when I say be who you are on purpose, if you're a dad, be a dad on purpose. Be a dad with passion. Be a dad because it's something that you chose and you're going to do it well. You're going to excel at it. And when people come with some narrative, some new science, like, you know, here we made something up and we're peddling that. You need to talk to your kids about that. They need to know where you stand. They need to know what you embrace. And, you know, church membership in this country has dropped below 50% for the first time in our country's history. And people that don't ever go to church, divorce rate 70% higher than those who do. There are all these kind of spin-off benefits from these sorts of things. It's just family time. And I think one of the reasons it's dropped off is because the birth rates dropped so low. Birth rates like 1.6 now. We need 2.1 to sustain our infrastructure. We've got to start, when I say be who you are on purpose, we're families. Be a family on purpose. Be a member of the family on purpose. Call your parents. Call your siblings. Start engaging as a family. This is a book that I think, if you read this book I've written, and 30 days afterwards, your neighbors don't look at you and say, "What happened? You've changed how you're being in this world," then I wasted my time. This is a book that's going to change the way people be in this world. And that's what I think we need to do to get this country back where it needs to be.
We'll get to more on this in just a moment. First, when you want the best tickets at any sporting event or concert, you have to act quickly or somebody else is going to grab it instead. Similarly, if you're hiring for your business, you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. The best way to do that is with ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter helps you find qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/BenGuest. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology shows you qualified people for that role. Once you've reviewed your list of qualified candidates, you can swiftly invite your top choices to apply. This streamlined process encourages them them to apply sooner, allowing you to fill that role faster. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best talent fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter will get a quality candidate within the first day. Just head on over to ZipRecruiter.com/BenGuest. Try it for free. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/BenGuest. ZipRecruiter is indeed the smartest way to hire. We've been using it for years here at The Daily Wire. It's a great way for you to upgrade your employees and get great new employees. Go check right now, ZipRecruiter.com/BenGuest. Check it out. Get started. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Now, obviously, you're not just, great at your job and a good dad and have an amazing family, but also you've built this massive business. And I think a lot of people right now are looking around the United States and they've lost all hope that there's upward mobility in America, which to me is the most bizarre lost hope of all time. Every single person I know who is extraordinarily wealthy started off as not extraordinarily wealthy. And obviously that's true for me, that's true for you, that's true for pretty much everybody that I know who's extraordinarily wealthy. This is why it drives me absolutely up a wall when I hear politicians talk about the classes, the upper class, the middle class, the low. No one is permanently in those classes in the United States. This isn't Britain in 1812. That's not the way that this works. No. You're not born into a landed estate and then you live the rest of your life in the landed estate with the downstairs maid who's taking care of all of your needs. The truth is many people in this country started as the downstairs maid and ended up at the top of the estate. What is your sort of view on what needs to be inculcated in America's young people with regard to the ability to prosper in business, and what do they need to do to get from point A to point B?
Well, they need to reject this narrative that, I've done shows. I've started this new network, Merritt Street Media. As you know, we launch April 2nd, so a week from today, actually. And I've been shooting shows in anticipation of our launch. I try to get some ahead. And I've done shows on quiet quitting and lazy girl jobs. And all of these young people are saying, hey, the statistics say we're going to be the first generation that aren't going to do as well as our parents. We're not going to be able to own a home. We're not going to be able to prosper. So what's the point? I mean, we're just kind of going to ride along. There's even this phenomenon now called doom spending. It's like there's no hope, there's no future, so just blow all your money now. I mean, they act as though stupidity were a virtue. Are you kidding me? If everybody thinks that, I look at it like being at a NASCAR race and everybody else is in the pits and you got an open track. If everybody wants to think that, be the one who gets it and says, if everybody wants to pull off the track, I got open running. If everybody wants to be a quiet quitter and do only the least little bit you can to get by, how easy is it to distinguish yourself? How easy is it to stand out against the crowd? This is a player's game now. Everybody needs to step back and say, if I'm the one that says, I'm going to work, I'm going to get consequential knowledge, that is knowledge I have where I can't be replaced by noon tomorrow, whether it's a computer repairman or a plumber or a brain surgeon or whatever, I'm going to find that for me and I'm going to distinguish myself. There's never been a better opportunity in America than right now to be a success, because you've got a bunch of people that are listening to this. Oh, hey, it's we want equality of outcome, so chill. Everybody's going to wind up the same. Well, we've tried that. They called it socialism. Didn't work. Got hundreds of thousands of corpses to prove that. If a bunch of people want to be thinking that, man, it just gives you greater opportunity, less competition. I hope everybody rejects that, but until they do, if you're one of the first that does, what a great opportunity for you. People say, Dr. Phil, why are you starting a new network at your age? You don't have to work. You could be out playing golf, doing anything. If you live without passion, what's the point? Man, I got a passion for what I'm doing. Just like you do. I watch you all the time. I subscribe to the Daily Wire. I follow you all the time. You don't do this for anything other than passion. It's very apparent in what you do. Can you imagine living without passion? That would be terrible. I'm fueled by passion. That's why I want to do. Find your passion and chase it. I mean, that's what I tell people they need to do.
So, yeah, final question for you, because I know you have to run. What, you know, when you seem congenitally optimistic, right? When you look at the state of the country, you know, how optimistic should we be that people turn it around, figure it out, and get back on track?
We have the ability. If it was like, okay, we got to push a 1,000-pound rock up a muddy hill, I'd say, well, you know, there's not too much going to happen. But we have the ability, Ben. We've got we have the moral compass in this country. We just need to decide we're not going to pay the most attention to the loudest voice. We need to be the people that say, look, I know facts. I know the truth. It may not be popular right now, but it will be there when everything else just evaporates and goes. When people come and tell me, you know, there are more than two sexes, yeah, you know, that might be kind of the popular idea of today. But you know what? There are two sexes. And there were 500 years ago. There will be 500 years from now. And I don't tell people how to live their lives unless they ask me. And when they ask me, I tell them, but I don't stop cars on the highway and say, you need to do this. I really don't. I'm the last one at a party to give advice. You know, people will be talking around, say, well, he should this, he should that. I answer questions, but I truly believe that we have the heart. We have the soul to turn this around. And the reason I wrote this book is I wanted to give people the facts to push back against these people that are trying to hijack the narrative. I want to be able to say, hey, let me tell you, that's not right. You know, there are four or five European countries that have done massive studies on gender-affirming care compared to psychotherapy, and they quit doing it because there was no difference in outcome between the two. So why are we still doing it? I mean, here are the studies. Read them. Make up your own mind. There aren't enough people that know this has been tested, and that there was no difference in outcome between psychotherapy versus surgery, hormonal treatments, or whatever. And why we're still doing it when there have been robust studies that show that you can get to the same place without altering the person's chemistry or anatomy, and we're still doing it. I want them to have information like that so they can push back. People just need to be armed and then have the strength of their convictions, and I believe we can do that.
Well, Dr. Phil, really appreciate the time. The brand new book is We've Got Issues, How You Can Stand Strong for America's Soul and Sanity. Go pick up a copy today. Dr. Phil, appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Ben. I'll see you soon.
Ben Shapiro Show Sunday Special is produced by Savannah Dominguez-Morris. Associate producer is Jake Pollock. Editing is by Jim Nickel. Audio is mixed by Mike Coromina. Post-production is managed by Matt Kemp. Camera and lighting is by Zach Ginta. Hair, makeup, and wardrobe by Fabiola Cristina. Title graphics are by Cynthia Angulo. Executive assistant, Kelly Carvalho. Executive in charge of production is David Wormis. Executive producer, Justin Siegel. Executive producer, Jeremy Boring. The Ben Shapiro Show Sunday Special is a Daily Wire production.
Introducing two new and improved Jeremy's Razors. Fighting the left and building the future means constantly bringing your best, and that's exactly what Jeremy's Razors is doing. Choose between the new and improved Precision 5 Razor for an exceptionally smooth and close shave, or the brand new Sprint 3 Razor for a quick, clean shave. The new razors feature top-to-bottom redesign. Enjoy an ergonomic handle designed for superior durability. The new coated stainless steel blades are sharper, so they last longer. Increased flexibility allows the razor to better contour to your face to reduce nicks and cuts. Plus, the lubricating strip is now equipped with argan oil and aloe. It's time to toss out that woke razor and get yourself a Precision 5 or Sprint 3 trial kit today. Pledge to fight the left and build a future with Jeremy's Razors. Go to jeremysrazors.com and order yours today.
We'll get to more on this in just one moment. First, $20 barely gets you anything these days. You can't even fill your gas tank or get a burger and fries for less than $20. But do you know what $20 will get you? From the cell phone company I use, Pure Talk, you can get unlimited talk, text, and plenty of 5G data for just $20 a month. Pure Talk gives you the same quality of service as your current cell phone provider, but for half the cost. The average family saves almost $1,000 a year, all with no contracts and no activation fees. You can switch to Pure Talk and keep the phone and phone number you currently use, or you can take advantage of their great deals on the latest iPhones and Androids, making the switch incredibly easy. Their U.S. customer service team can help you join Pure Talk in as little as 10 minutes. Choose to spend your hard-earned money with a wireless company that shares your values, supports our military and veterans, creates American jobs, and refuses to advertise on those fake news networks. So stop spending a ridiculous amount of money on your phone plan. Go to puretalk.com/Shapiro right now. My listeners can get an additional 50% off their very first month of coverage. That's puretalk.com/Shapiro. Again, start saving money on your phone plan today with people who actually like you. Go to puretalk.com/Shapiro and start saving.